When I am home, if the television is on, the remote is usually in my hand, and I watch what I want to watch. And if I don't want to watch something, I don't watch it. But when I am out in public and happen to be someplace where there is a television on, I don't have any control over what's on, and that frustrates me sometimes, especially considering the television programs that most public places are going to broadcast. You're either going to have to sit and watch one of those networks that has initials for a name, and the totally realistic scenario of a couple who says, I want a retirement house on an island, and I only have $750,000, bless my heart, as a budget. So you're going to have to make that fit. Or one of the cable news networks is on, and that's way worse. And it really doesn't matter which one. It's just way worse. And you sit there and you are just, unless you have earphones or, you know, headphones or earplugs or something, you are bombarded with negative message after negative message and negative story after negative story. And it's not hard to understand at all how so many people in the world would come to the conclusion or get the impression that evil is winning, that wickedness is winning. We are surrounded by wickedness in every conceivable shape and form. And it is depressing to think about and depressing to contemplate. So what do we do? And especially those of us who are Christians, those of us who love God the Father, those of us who adore and worship and honor the Son, and who respect and revere the message that was guided by the Holy Spirit to teach us all the things that we need. What do we do in circumstances or in a situation where we find ourselves completely surrounded by wickedness, when it looks like wickedness is winning? And I want to share with you this morning for just a few minutes something that I've been doing for a long time. When I get overwhelmed by this negative message of all the bad things that are going on in the world, Psalm 2 has been a refuge for me. And I think that Psalm 2 was intended by God to be exactly this kind of refuge. It is a fascinating psalm, only 12 verses, not very long, but it contains an incredibly powerful message. And you can divide the second psalm up into four parts. In part one, you have the nations raging and plotting. And by the way, what I want you to think about and what I want you to notice as we look at each one of these four points just very quickly is how apt a description Psalm 2 is of what's going on in the world today. The nations plot and rage. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves. The Amplified Bible renders the Hebrew there, the kings of the earth take their stand. And I think that that is exactly what is under consideration here. The kings of the earth are taking a stand. And taking a stand against what? Taking a stand against who? Not taking a stand, not setting themselves against each other. Notice that the psalmist says they set themselves, they take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. And that is exactly what we see from politicians, from governments, from rulers in the world today, taking their stand against God, setting themselves against God and against the Father's anointed. It would be tragic if it ended there, but it doesn't. Because the psalmist goes on to tell us that the Father has a reaction to that. And the Father's reaction is interesting. God the Father's reaction is interesting. He laughs. He laughs. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. By the way, this is not David telling us that the Lord is especially amused about what's going on in the world. It is derision. It is God, in effect, saying, who do they think they are? Plotting against me. Plotting against my anointed. I am God. I am the creator. I made the world. I gave them the right to sit in the positions of authority where they sit. Who do they think they are? It always makes me smile when I hear some politician or some entertainer or some news pundit mocking God, mocking God's word, mocking God's moral standard, to just picture in my mind God in heaven laughing. And laughing in derision. But not only does God laugh, the psalmist says God gets mad. As a matter of fact, strong words are used. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have a king too. I have a ruler too. I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. And then the anointed one, the king whom God has set on his holy hill, the anointed one speaks, the son speaks. And we know that that son is the right designation because that's what he calls himself as he reveals what God says to him. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, and then at verse 6, God says, I have a king too. And I've set my king on my holy hill. And now the king speaks. And let me tell you what God said to me. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. Look at verse 9. I love this. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. This is the Son speaking. The nations are plotting against God. They have set themselves against God. They're going to overthrow God. And God laughs in derision. And he gets angry. As a matter of fact, it's called wrath and fury. And his response is, look, I have a king also. And the king now acknowledges, the father told me, all you have to do is ask, I will give you all of these nations. I will make the ends of the earth all your possession, and you will rule over them. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. And then the psalmist draws some conclusions. The nations set themselves against God. They rage and set themselves against God. God laughs and gets angry. The son acknowledges that the father has indeed set him in place. And now the psalmist finishes up with a warning and some comfort. He goes back to the kings of the earth. What about those politicians? What about those news pundits? What about those entertainers who are setting themselves against God? Be wise, O kings. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son. The Hebrew is the idea of bowing down to the Son. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry. Remember, God the Father is already angry. God the Father has already expressed his wrath and his fury. You better pacify the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. So there's the warning. What is the significance of Psalm 2? And why is it that Psalm 2 serves as a source of comfort in the world that we live in today? A couple of things about the second psalm that are interesting, I think. Psalm 2 is designated by scholars as one of the royal psalms. There are either 10 or 11 royal psalms, depending on which commentator or which scholar you look at. But the idea of the royal psalms is an emphasis that God is keeping his promise to David. And the promise that he made to David was that David would have an eternal kingdom. that there would always be a descendant of David who would sit on his throne. We don't have time, or I won't take the time this morning, but you can read that promise in 2 Samuel chapter 7. It's 1 Chronicles chapter 17 repeats it. Peter mentions that promise in the first sermon that he preaches in Acts chapter 2. The royal psalms have to do with the lineage of David, the heritage of David, that David would have an eternal kingdom. Now, depending on the commentary, depending on the source that you look at, what is the significance of the royal psalms? What is this? Who is this son in Psalm 2 about whom David is speaking? There are a lot of commentators who would suggest that he's talking about literal people, literal descendants of David, starting with Rehoboam, or Solomon, starting with Solomon, and then Rehoboam, and going on, the physical descendants of David who were sitting on the throne. I looked at a commentary a few days ago that suggested that this Psalm, Psalm 2, I don't know what the source of this was. I didn't investigate it any further. But this particular commentary suggested Psalm 2, the reading of Psalm 2 accompanied the coronation ceremony of every king of Judah. And when the crown was placed upon his head, the words were spoken, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Whether that's true or not, I think is really insignificant. And I think it's insignificant for this reason. Israel had no good kings. The northern kingdom didn't have a single good king. Israel had a few good kings, but not many. And even the best of the kings of Judah do not fit the picture that is painted of the Son who is set on the throne by the Father on the holy hill of Zion in the second psalm. These psalms, the point I'm trying to make is this. These psalms are messianic. The royal psalms aren't pointing to men who will sit on the throne of David, the literal throne of David in Jerusalem, and rule as heirs of David. The promise in 2 Samuel chapter 7 did not involve David's physical heirs, the immediate physical heirs. 1 Chronicles chapter 17. Again, Peter makes that clear in Acts chapter 2 when he says that Christ was the fulfillment of that promise to David. These psalms are messianic psalms. And lest there is any question about that, that's exactly how the New Testament references Psalm 2. And so in Acts chapter 13, when Paul is preaching in Antioch of Pisidia, he says, "And we bring to you the good news that what God promised to the fathers, this he has fulfilled to us, their children." What promise? The promise in Psalm 2, that I will set my son on the throne in Zion on God's holy hill. This he has fulfilled to us, their children, by raising Jesus. As it is also written in the second psalm, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." Paul leaves no doubt that when God challenged the rulers of the world, he wasn't talking about David, he wasn't talking about Solomon, he wasn't talking about Rehoboam, he wasn't talking about Hezekiah, he wasn't talking about Josiah. God was talking about Christ. God was talking about Jesus. "I have a king too," God says, "and I have placed him on the throne. In Zion, in my holy hill." The author of the book of Hebrews does exactly the same thing with the second psalm. In Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 5, "For to which of the angels did God ever say, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you'?" He quotes from the second psalm in reference to Jesus. And I love this in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 5. Because in Psalm 2, When God is responding to the nations who were raging against him and plotting against him, he warns those kings, "You better not make the Son angry. Because listen, the Son will rule with a rod of iron," remember? And that's what Paul sees, or John, that is, sees in this vision in the book of Revelation. He sees the woman giving birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. There is no doubt in my mind at all that what Solomon or what David saw in this second psalm, the first of the 10 or 11 royal psalms, is he saw that God was going to set Christ on David's throne, figuratively, symbolically, and that Christ was going to rule the nations, and that he would rule them, he says, with a rod of iron. And the significance of that is extreme, I think, for us. The more we know about history in the first century, and we're learning more about history in the first century, about Roman history in the first century, and about the leftover remnants of Greek history in the first century, and pagan history in the first century, and even Jewish history in the first century, the more we learn about and the more we know about the political and social and racial an economic atmosphere into which Christianity was born. And at that time at which God fulfilled the prophecy of the second psalm, when he sat his son on the throne to rule over all the nations, that culture is so very similar to the culture in which we live today. The immorality, the corruption, the crime, the prejudice, the racism, the poverty, in every way, we've come full circle. As Timothy would remind us of the day, each of the weeks, I'll just keep it to the year, 2019. We've come 2,000 years. We're living in first century Rome. We're living in the first century Roman world. So why is it that Paul in a sermon in Antioch of Pisidia would quote the second psalm? Now, why is it that the author of the book of Hebrews, in exalting Christ to his rightful position of authority, would quote from the second psalm? Why is it that John would remind us in the book of Revelation that when this child was born, this is the child who would rule the world with a rod of iron, who would rule over the nations with a rod of iron? I think there are several things that come to mind. Several things that are helpful, as a matter of fact. Really, the first one, I think, is the most important. At least it is for me, that no matter what is going on in the world, God is in control. Well, whatever comes out of the White House or the State House or the courthouse, whatever comes out of Hollywood, God is in control. And again, I have no picture when I hear, I watch very little news. And I'm not ashamed to admit that. I'm not embarrassed to admit that. I've said that before publicly and had even Christians come up to me and say, well, that's terrible. We have to be informed. We have to know what's going on. Says who? I know what's going on. God is in control, and Jesus is on his throne, and Jesus is ruling with a rod of iron. And that gives me, I don't know about you, but that gives me considerable comfort. I would think Christians in the first century would have taken great comfort in knowing it's not Nero, it is not Tiberius, it is not Claudius, it is not Caligula, it is not Vespasian. God is in control. God is sovereign. God is over all. Jesus is on the throne. The claim that Jesus made right before he went back to heaven, that God has given me all authority, with the exception of God the Father himself, God has given me all power, all authority in heaven and on earth. That hasn't changed in 2,000 years. And so when our politicians, when our entertainers, when our news men and women mock God, God is laughing in derision. And God is angry. And God would remind them he is still in control. The second message that is significant to us from the second psalm is that those who oppose the purposes and will of God are going to pay. the politicians. I'll make it practical and personal. The politicians, the entertainers, the news people who are promoting vigorously and violently abortion are going to pay for it. Maybe not in this life, but they will pay. God hasn't turned a blind eye. God sees what's going on. God knows. And they're going to pay. Those who promote sex outside of marriage, those who promote homosexuality, those who promote all kinds of sexual perversion, they're going to pay. Maybe not in this life, but eventually they are. The second psalm makes it clear God will not let these acts of rage, these acts of plotting against Him, these acts of trying to overthrow His rule and overthrow His authority, He will not let them go unpunished. Ultimately, everyone is going to stand before God in judgment. I'll be very candid about this, that this is just a feeling. But I have a feeling that God can't let the United States of America keep going much longer. And what gives me that feeling is when I read about the Chaldeans in the Old Testament, when I read about the Assyrians and the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Persians and the Medes and the Greeks and the Romans. When I read about them in the Old Testament, and I read about some even carrying over into the New Testament, and I read the prophets, especially when I read the prophets and see that there comes a time in the lives of nations when God will draw a line in the sand and say, this is far enough. I will not go with this nation any further. And none of those nations exist any longer. They're all long gone. And they're gone because of God. They're gone because God got tired of the immorality. He got tired of the arrogance. He got tired of the pride. And He finally said enough is enough. And He removed them. And I have no reason that I can find in either the Old or the New Testament to believe that God has decided that He will deal differently with nations now. God is in control, and those who oppose God will ultimately suffer God's wrath. That's why we need to be making sure that we are taking refuge in God's Son. That's I thought about this on Friday night when Timothy was preaching, and this was really the main point of Timothy's lesson number 3 here at the end, is that we need to be taking refuge in Jesus, and we need to be teaching people to take refuge in Jesus Christ. How do we fix the political mess that's going on in the world? It is not by getting our people elected to some political office. We fix it by turning people to Jesus, by teaching people to seek refuge in Jesus, by trying to find good and honest hearts. Because ultimately, again, only those people who are, as we sometimes sing, safe in the arms of Jesus, only those people are going to survive and be blessed in eternity. Only those people. So what do we do? You know, what do we do? What do you do? What do I do? I'm telling you, this is what I do. When I am full to the top and sick of being bombarded with the message that wickedness is winning, I go back and read the second psalm. Yes, things are bad, but God is in control and His Son is on the throne. Evil is not winning. Wickedness is not winning. Ultimately, God will balance the books. God will bring everything to right. So the question is, what about you? You know, the question is really not what about the United States of America. The question this morning is, what about you? Are you in a right relationship with God? Maybe you're like me. So that sometimes you get discouraged when you look around and see how bad things are. Remember, God is in control. And Jesus is on the throne. And God will make everything right. Are you in a right relationship with God? If you're not a Christian, or if you are a Christian and you've said or done something that's caused you to be separated from God, maybe you're just discouraged by how badly it seems things are going in the world, put your confidence and trust in Jesus. Obey the gospel if that's what you need to do. Come back into a right relationship with God. Read the second Psalm. And just remind yourself, no matter how bad things look, God is in control. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to just survive this sinful old world so that we can be in heaven together with God in eternity. So that we can share that incredible victory. If you're here and you are subject to God's invitation in any way and we can help you, please let us know how we can serve you by coming down to one of these front seats. Do that right now while we stand and sing. We invite you to come.